Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The new autism numbers are stunning, sobering. One in 88 American children, we're now told. One in 54 American boys. The new CDC report out last week was a conversation stopper and starter. How could this possibly be? Yes, there's a spectrum from severe to mild, but could that many American children really be on it? And if so, why? This hour on Point, what is going on with autism? Joining me first today is Dr. Max Wisnitzer, pediatric neurologist at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland. He's been treating children with autism for more than two decades, a nationally recognized practitioner in a tough, challenging field. Dr. Wisnitzer, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Could you help us understand first, I mean, these numbers just turned everybody's heads. What are we really talking about here? There's all kinds of manifestations of this, and lots of great kids out there, and not only kids at this point, who have some touch or maybe a lot. But the definition itself seems to be maybe a part of what's going on. What are we talking about in this spectrum?
Well, in the old days, it was clearly defined. You were talking about more severely affected individuals with problems with socialization, communication, and certain behaviors. With the newer diagnostic criteria, they've really expanded it. But we need to emphasize that even the mildly impaired individuals should have significant problems. This really has to interfere with their day-to-day functioning, and it impacts their socialization, which means how they interact with other people. Mm-hmm. It impacts how they use their language to interact with other people, which is social communication. And they tend to have either restricted interests, which means areas in which they have fascinations or something that they're really interested in, or they have some behaviors such as spinning, finger flicking, rocking, and behaviors of that type.
It's neurological, but it's really diagnosed by behavior, not by any clear pattern that you can sort of do a biopsy or something and see.
No, this is similar to many developmental disorders. Developmental disorders are really based on the clinical presentation. It's not only autism spectrum disorder, we're also ADHD, mm-hmm. Intellectual impairment, which we used to know as mental retardation. All of these are clinically based diagnoses. The studies that are done to try to define the reason why, not to tell you the features. An example I always give parents: if something has four legs, a tail, hair, and goes woof, you know it's a dog. You don't really have to go and do a biopsy and do anything else like that. The same thing here, that it's clinically based, and those people who have sufficient experience in evaluating these individuals can identify them.
We're going to look at a lot of angles of this hour, but just your response first. When you heard these numbers, one in 88 American kids, one in 54 boys, I mean, it was only a handful of years ago, it was one in 110. Just 10 years ago, one in 150. I mean, these numbers are up 1,000% from 40 years ago. So what was your response when you heard them?
I'm not surprised. Number one, I think our diagnostic criteria are being applied more liberally, which means it's a much expanded group of individuals, especially when they're looking at individuals with social impairments. But the other thing is we're getting much better at identifying them. As you mentioned, 20, 30 years ago, no one knew what autism was. Nowadays, everybody knows, up to the point that parents, to some degree, walk in with any child with a developmental problem, and their first concern is it autism?
Mm-hmm. And obviously, with numbers like these, you can't blame them for thinking that. So as people are listening right now, and you deal with this all the time, do you think we're just shifting the goalpost here in a way in our screening? The CDC was suggesting this may just be better screening that catches more cases. Or do we have an actual material, foundational increase in the percentage of American kids who have somewhere on the spectrum?
Well, let's look at it. Let's take these numbers and basically analyze them more carefully. Mm-hmm. They clearly tell us that we've got a group of individuals with developmental problems. That is a given. The question is, how do you define it? If you read the CDC report carefully, you find out half that population was based solely on their educational records. And research has shown that sometimes the children identified through the educational system seem to have a different constellation of findings than those that are identified through the medical system. Are we talking about the same disorder? Are we talking about other kids with impairments of socialization? And there's a wide spectrum of conditions that can cause social impairment. Mm-hmm. Either way, at the bottom line, it doesn't really matter what we call it. If we identify that they have a problem, we know that they need some help. In my opinion, I think to some degree we have over-labeling. But again, we may not have the right label, but if you do the right intervention, that's all that's important.
Oh, so some over-labeling. And what about at the base of this? What about just more incidence of this? Do you think there's simply more autism in the population?
I don't think we have numbers that definitely would tell us this. Look at the reasons why we can have more numbers. One is, we'll say, more liberalized diagnostic criteria. Okay. Number two is greater awareness so that the public knows about it, the people who make the diagnosis know about it. There's also an increase in populations that have risk factors. So, for instance, people are having children at an older age, and we know that parents of older children have a higher risk for this. We now know that, as we've looked at numbers, that the risk, for instance, if you have one child with autism, the risk of a second child with autism is 20%. We have a lot of factors that can lead to explanations. We have no proof yet, no definite proof that an increased incidence, which means an increased number of new cases, is the reason. Could that be a reason? The answer is yes, but we need better data before we jump to that conclusion. If you look at what people have done in other countries, I mean, there are other countries that have identified numbers that are even more prevalent than what you've just quoted. Why is it that if we're using the same criteria, we're defining things, we're finding different numbers, we're defining things in different ways? Is everyone applying the principles the same way?
So we can see that they could be applied differently. That would come up with different numbers. It's still striking when they jump so markedly, just sort of a cluster of years after cluster of years. I mean, you said you think there probably is an actual base gain going on here beneath all this.
But yes, there very well may be. But let's look at reasons why kids could have social impairments. You can have autism as one reason. You can have social anxiety, or if people think of that as extreme shyness, is another one. The ADHD population frequently have social immaturity. If you have individuals with cognitive impairment, what we used to call mental retardation, they're socially they're going to be behind their peers. If you just superficially look at them, you may inadvertently classify them as being within the autism spectrum rather than with the grouping that they're in. We still need more data telling us that we're actually on target with our definitions and with our descriptions before we can make a conclusion about an increased incidence. If you were going to talk increased incidence, mm-hmm. there are studies that are ongoing that are looking at that. There's questions about and potential environmental risk factors that are affecting the developing baby. In other words, things that affect the brain while the baby is still developing in the womb, not after birth, but in the womb. Could it be that there's some exposure to some substances? All of this is being researched, but for the most part, it's still conjecture. No proven causal association, which means A cause B, has been demonstrated in the vast majority of situations.
So our antenna are way up. We've got screening and maybe different depths of screening, different success of screening. More liberal interpretation, maybe. All that at play here. I mean, some of those things sound like good things, Dr. Wisnitzer. If it helps families deal with their kids and their situation and the people are more attuned.
I can quote a teacher who basically said to me a long time ago that she doesn't care what my diagnosis is as long as her evaluation tells her what the child needs. And I think the same thing here. The critical point is to identify kids with developmental disabilities. Even before you call it autism, you first have to identify that there's a problem that's present. In our country, we still have issues about developmental screening and getting it done accurately. If you look at numbers in pediatric practices, about half of pediatric practices do routine developmental screening. That means half don't. That could be one reason why we're not picking these kids up at the times that we're supposed to. I always believe in getting back to the basics rather than putting a specific label. Before the label, we need to know what we're dealing with, that there is a problem, evaluate it carefully, and then determine what to do about it.
Dr. Max Wisnitzer, please stand by there in Cleveland. I want to welcome into our conversation from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Dr. Geraldine Dawson. She's a professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and also chief science officer for Autism Speaks. It's the nation's largest autism advocacy group. Dr. Dawson, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So here's Dr. Wisnitzer in Cleveland saying, look, there's a whole spectrum of things to look at here, and it may be screening. The CDC saying last week it may be more, better screening and awareness. Now, your group is an advocacy group, but you're saying national public health emergency, autism epidemic. Why do you put it in those terms?
Right. Well, we're a science and advocacy organization, and so let me just make a few comments about these new alarming statistics. First of all, it's important to keep in mind that the CDC has used exactly the same methods every year. So every year they've been looking at records and keeping those methods exactly the same so we can systematically monitor the increase. So we can't really attribute the changes that we've seen in prevalence to something about the methods and the way that the CDC has been looking at educational records, for example. And in addition, there's been some really excellent research over the last several years that has examined the extent to which things like broader diagnosis, increased awareness, diagnostic substitution, where maybe a child was diagnosed previously with intellectual disability, now autism, and access to services, and looked at how those contribute to the increase, and indeed they do. But what you find is that after you account for all of those factors, there still remains about 50% of the increase that is unexplained. And that's why we feel that it's prudent to be really looking at environmental risk factors as well. And indeed, the research is already identifying a number of environmental risk factors that can contribute to a risk for autism.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about rates of autism. Autism diagnosis way up, and we are asking why. New numbers out last week say 1 in 88 American children now have some kind of autism diagnosis. 1 in 54 boys. Dr. Geraldine Dawson is with us. She's Chief Science Officer for Autism Speaks, joins us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Dr. Max Wisnitzer is with us. He's a pediatric neurologist at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland, works with a lot of these cases, and so do a lot of American families. Here's an interview from last week on NBC News. Tiffany Myers, her 3-year-old son Aiden was diagnosed with autism. She describes here the day when doctors confirmed her fear.
When I went to the doctor finally, I prepared myself, and I think I knew in the back of my mind. I tried to prepare myself for it the whole ride to the doctor, and I don't think that anything... I told myself I was going to be okay with it, and the day, it was a hard day.
It was a hard day. I mean, there are lives here, very beautiful lives, but they can be difficult, difficult for the kids themselves, difficult for families. Here's a teenager, Matthew Ryan Morin, diagnosed with high-functioning autism. He produced a series of YouTube videos explaining to the world what it's like to have autism. Here he is in a video posted last summer explaining why people with autism have trouble making eye contact.
When people talk to us, we are supposed to be making eye contact with them. Making eye contact shows that you are paying attention to what they have to say, and you care about what they have to say, right? But now with individuals with autism like myself, we find it difficult to give eye contact. Almost all individuals with autism have that issue.
And of course, we are social creatures. That makes things difficult. Here's one more YouTube user, Clever Genevieve, she calls herself, explaining how her high-functioning autism affects her brain.
It affects the way I think. I think very literally. I'm very straightforward. Symbolism, hidden meanings, stuff like that, it's hard for me to grasp.
Doctors Geraldine Dawson and Max Wisnitzer are with us. In a moment, we'll be joined by the mother of 20-something with autism. Geraldine Dawson, what do you make, then, of the increase in these numbers? If you don't think it's just diagnosis, if you think maybe it's 50% unexplained by better screening, what might be going on here?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to stress that we do have a public health crisis at this point, and we do need a national plan to try to address not only the need for research, but also better early detection, early intervention, and the development of more effective treatments. We have to presume at this point that environmental risk factors are playing a role. We already have some evidence of some of those environmental risk factors.
Like what?
Well, for example, the ones that have been shown so far are ones that affect the very early brain development of a baby, typically in the prenatal period. So some examples are advanced age at the time of conception.
What qualifies as advanced, if I may?
40 years and above.
Okay.
Both fathers and mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Nutrition during pregnancy. So we have some evidence that taking folic acid before conception and during the early prenatal period may reduce the risk for autism.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's studies that are exploring the role of vitamin D during pregnancy. But we also have quite good evidence now that, that babies who are born very low birth weight and or have birth complications that involve anoxia or lack of oxygen to the brain, that those babies are at risk for autism. And then finally, there's some research that's emerging and has a couple of these have been replicated now that show that exposure by the mother during pregnancy to high levels of pesticides or even air pollution can increase risk for autism. Now, let me just say that these are these are modest increases in risk that likely interact with genetic susceptibility. So
okay.
We believe that both genes and environment play a role.
Dr. Wisnitzer, when you hear a list like that, what are you thinking in the back of your mind? Does it line up with your experience, your observation, or are you skeptical?
I'm not skeptical about most of these points.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the studies, for instance, the studies on pesticides and air pollution, are more of an association study rather than something that says definitely the cause. It's not surprising when you're dealing with children who are born extremely low birth weight, which means they're born very early because the brain still has a lot to go in terms of its development.
Mm-hmm.
And being outside the womb can clearly impact on how the brain develops, where the nerve fibers go, and in susceptible individuals can clearly trigger this. I think when the comment was made here that what we have is a public health crisis, we have to look at other numbers for other developmental disorders. If you look at something as simple as ADHD,
okay.
In the same time period that the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder went up 87%, ADHD went up 66%. We're dealing with some factors that are here. It's not only autism itself. The question again comes back to, is it something that's affecting them, or is it that we're just getting better at identifying them?
So are you resisting the notion of a public health emergency here or an autism epidemic, as Autism Speaks puts it, Dr. Wilson?
I don't like to use the word epidemic. I think Dr. Dawson and I clearly agree that I agree with all her points. More research is needed. Early identification is needed. More effective treatments are needed, not only for autism but for all other developmental disorders that impact on children. Our jobs as pediatricians is to basically to advocate for all children, and there are children who have conditions other than autism where they need help. They need to be identified early on because intervention makes a difference. I think the best word to use is we need to have heightened awareness of that developmental disorders are out in the population and need to be identified and treated.
Geraldine Dawson, I'm looking here at a commentary on CNN. This is from Catherine Lord. She is director of the Center for Autism and the Developing Brain at Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. She says that because this latest survey, these numbers were based on looking at 14 different regions around the country, and she says she wonders if some of these sites became part of the study because they have a long-term commitment to autism services, that they've drawn certain families to live nearby because they're offering better services and more focus on this, and therefore result in more frequency of diagnosis. Maybe we've got clustering here. What do you say about that, Dr. Dawson?
Well, if anything, I think the current prevalence estimates from the CDC study are likely an underestimate of the number of children affected by autism in the U.S. And the reason why we believe that is because of the methods that was used to conduct the study. These are based on children who have either a diagnosis or enough symptoms that are in a medical record that a diagnosis or an educational record could be made. And so we have recently funded a study in South Korea where they used a different approach and screened an entire population, and then anyone who was positive on that screen was brought in and given a diagnostic evaluation. Using that approach, we found an estimate of 1 in 38. So currently, we're working with the CDC and funding a similar study that will be collected at one of the CDC sites that is going to use this total population screening approach. So we think that we have only scratched the surface here. So very unlikely that we're overestimating. And I, one
Tom,
other point, Tom, just very, go ahead,
Doctor. Was it?
This is Max. I just want to just on the South Korea study. There have been some individuals who have raised questions about the statistics that were used in order to calculate that number, because what they did was they had a small group of individuals and then they generalized the information and they made inherent assumptions that are there. There are individuals in the autism community who question the assumptions that are made and feel that the numbers that were quoted were overly generous and overly broad. The number may not be as frequent. It's still a number that's there. That's not a concern. It's not infrequent, but it's not as dramatic as was just quoted.
With your permission and Dr. Dawson's, I'd like to not try to wrestle that one all the way to the ground. Note that element of question about it, but I don't know if we can solve that right here. But just think of these numbers overall, Max. I mean, you've got people listening here who have young children or who are thinking about having children, and when you start talking about 1 in 54 for boys or 1 in 38, the South Korean number, what either of those. I mean, these are really frightening numbers. Here's Ashley writing to us on Facebook. You know, this is pretty staggering to think about. How should people take this on board, Max?
I think we look at it the other way around. Even if it's 1 in 54, it's about 2%. That means you got a 98% chance it's not going to be there. And if you look at other conditions, there's a much higher chance that some of these conditions are there.
Like
I
what?
I realize that it clearly ADHD, 8% risk that it's going to be there. Intellectual disability, mental retardation, 3% chance that that's going to be there. Learning disability, 6 to 8%, and that's a conservative number that they're going to be there. There's a lot of risks that are out there, and that assumes that these numbers are as accurate. My issue is that when I see children who've been labeled by other individuals and I put them through a very rigorous evaluation, many times a diagnosis falls to the wayside and another thing pops in. And that's what raises the question in my mind that if I'm seeing this overdiagnosis in my area, is this also happening that – because what we're doing in the CDC numbers – first of all, the CDC numbers is a range. It was a prevalence range. The numbers were low in some areas, higher in other areas. The number you quoted was the average. And I agree that this is clearly an issue that needs to be addressed. This is an issue that we need to be aware of with services provided.
But now you're saying overdiagnosis. Geraldine Dawson was saying underdiagnosis. Why would there be overdiagnosis, Mac? What factors would lead to that?
I think autism is on everyone's minds, and I think some people who make the diagnosis, especially if they don't have a lot of experience with seeing individuals with autism spectrum disorders, take an impairment in socialization and automatically assume that it's autism until proven otherwise, and don't look for the other reasons why the problem may be there.
Does it bring
one example.
Does it bring parents or schools more public support if the numbers are higher?
In Ohio, and I assume in other states in the union, autism is, as a special education diagnosis, is a higher rate of compensation for special ed services than other diagnoses except for traumatic brain injury. Also, parents are told erroneously by school systems that if you have the diagnosis of autism or autism spectrum disorder, then we can give you the following services. Service delivery in school systems is not based on a diagnosis. It's based on a child's needs. But that's not the message parents always get. It comes to me on a regular basis where parents say, if I have the label, I can get the following.
This is really, it can be confusing and concerning in so many directions at once. Dr. Wisnitzer, Dr. Dawson, stand by. Let me go to our listeners, Stephanie in Beverly, Massachusetts. Stephanie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for this program. I have a 13-year-old. He is not diagnosed on the spectrum. And what I want to say is the 1 in 54 number doesn't shock me. And I think the children who flirt with this and struggle with this every day is much greater. My son has dyslexia, dyscalculia, dysgraphia, dyspraxia, and sensory integration challenges. Not for lack of trying. We did not even find out, what kind of support he should need. As an infant, he had trouble crawling.
Mm-hmm.
We would tell our pediatrician. We would bring things to the attention of the school, and we were continually dismissed with children develop at different rates. It turns out that most likely everything from his vision to his reading to his physical, balance and bilateral and motor coordination problems, had he had early intervention, could have been greatly lessened. And so the severity of our lifetime, and we are just for a way of information, educated, formerly middle-class parents. We wound up selling our house so that we could put him in a school that would help him out.
Yeah.
And ideally, services should be delivered at the school level. But we had a diagnosis of dyslexia, and we could not even get reading help.
Stephanie, are you relieved that he was not diagnosed on the autism spectrum, or do you wish he had been because he would have had more intervention, more support?
Well, you know what? I don't know that we would have had more intervention and support, although there would have been more knowledge. I think arose by any other name. I wouldn't say, you know, naming it, if he were diagnosable squarely in that category, I would only feel good if it would get him the help he needs. And any parent, you know, the only worse thing than realizing that your child has a challenge is not knowing how to meet it. So, you know, we're doing the best we can, and there's an entire category of kids in the gray area. I say, if you put my son in a group of children who have diagnosed Asperger's or autism, he clearly appears to be more neurotypical. If you put him in a group of neurotypical kids, he has, you know, struggles that they don't have, things that people don't even think about, you know, physically, you know, being able to run up and kick a ball. There's nothing obvious, but when we live with it day to day, the challenges of just daily living are very great for him.
And you know them very well as a parent, and we can hear what that's meant to your family. I appreciate that call. I mean, this gray area is there. Geraldine Dawson, Stephanie speaks of early intervention. How significant is that? If you have a child that is on the autism spectrum, how much difference does it, can it make to identify it early and get engaged?
Yeah, I can't emphasize this point enough. And thank you, Stephanie, for all the points you've made. It was just very, very helpful to hear from you. And one of the things I want to mention is this idea of early diagnosis, early intervention that she brings up. And the average age of diagnosis in the last CDC study was between 48 and 75 months. And yet we know we can reliably diagnose autism by 18 to 24 months, and that pediatricians are supposed to screen, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, at 18 and 24 months.
What difference does it make if they successfully...
It makes a huge difference. So children who receive early intensive intervention on average have an IQ gain of at least 17 points, which is, you know, over a standard deviation. There's increases in language, an increase in adaptive behavior, a lessening of the autism symptoms. So this means that the life trajectories of these children are changed, and the cost savings for society are also tremendous, because then the supports long-term are not as great.
Dr. Wisnitzer, that makes it sound as though overdiagnosis, if we characterize it that way, it may mean some young kids with autism wouldn't be discovered. You know, you sort of want to lean toward figuring it out to help them, or if I got something wrong.
More importantly, let me bring up something, a very important point that your caller just made, and I appreciate that she emphasized this. You do not need to have the doctor tell you to go to early intervention to make a phone call to your local early intervention team. If it doesn't matter if it's the healthcare provider, a therapist, or the family themselves who suspect that there's something developmentally not right with the child, call, get an early intervention evaluation. What the team is called early intervention, birth to three. In Ohio, it's called Help Me Grow. Call, get the evaluation. That's what the system is there for, to help identify the children and get them into the right programs.
And this is just about children we're speaking today. Of course, you know, these children grow up, and they still need all kinds of special attention. We'll come back and talk with Glenn Finland. She's written a new memoir, Next Stop, about her son, David. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I want to bring into our conversation from Washington right now, Glenn Finland. Her son, David, is now 25, has autism. She's written a really moving memoir about his experience of dealing with him as he moved into full adulthood, his 20s. It's called Next Stop, a memoir. There's an excerpt at our website. Glenn Finland, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Tom. Thank you.
You write very, very movingly about the challenges of watching your child grow from childhood into real adulthood and still wrestling with the meaning of his autism, how what that meant for him, what it meant for you. We'll look at that. But what are you thinking as these numbers go up and up in terms of the number of diagnoses we're seeing, Glenn?
Well, I think the diagnosis creep makes sense for all of the reasons that your thoughtful experts have outlined today, the early screening, the detection, the intervention, and the greater awareness along with a broader definition. But for me, the question is, because these kids are growing up, my David is 24 now, when is the government going to confront this as the public health crisis that it is? Because we need to see what we can do for these kids and stop seeing them as targets for therapy and really focus on supported employment and competitive wages and jobs that will help them become independent adults. We need to welcome them into our workforce.
You're talking beyond childhood here, when they become young adults. And, of course, if the numbers are that much higher, I mean, maybe it's always been so. And, I mean, this does get back to this issue of whether we have more Americans now with autism or just more diagnosis. If it's not really more, then somehow, one way or another, for better or worse, it's been working. Is that a fair thing to say, Glenn?
Well, I tell you the truth, my book is not a prescriptive book. I'm only a mother, and I can tell you stories. And that's really what I've done here, because my book isn't about causes or cures. But
you're watching your 20-something, 24-now son in this environment, trying to live, trying to make a living, trying to live on his own. And, you know, these numbers suggest he is by no means the only one.
No, and it's hard to care about all of these numbers, and they're so abstract. There's so many people. So I suppose my book is just I'm hoping that you can care about one individual and that you can come away seeing that this is why the stories of the families who live it matter, because we help bring faces out of the shadows. And there's so many different kids. And, you know, in the autism community, we always say, if you've met one autistic kid, well, then you've met one autistic kid. Mm-hmm. And that's no joke. Each person is uniquely neurologically different. And so it's very hard to have one program for all of these maturing young adults. What are we going to do?
You think about these children moving into adult life, and you're David, just simply trying to get around the Washington, D.C. area on the subway. This, which would give him the independence to get out in the world and make a living. And that in itself, a huge challenge that you and he confronted together. I mean, I'm not sure people who don't have direct experience of this understand just how imposing it can be.
Well, you know, it's the story of the summer that I spent teaching my son David to ride the D.C. Metro solo, and in the process, he taught me how to let him go. And letting go is a huge issue for all parents, but I think for parents of young adults with autism, the stressors, the challenges are different. It's the emotional and physical fatigue. It's that 24/7, 365 days a year. It never stops, and that can also fray the edges of a marriage, even the strongest marriages. Mm-hmm. There are the financial worries as well. The older the child gets, we're talking now about rent and health insurance, and you know what job, how this person can become a contributor in our society, and you know it's really a civil rights issue, because work is a right, and these young people are entitled to work. So we need these supported jobs. But I have to say, you're talking about the Metro, the best investment that we ever made was that $1.35 Metro fare card, because it launched my David into independence. And you can imagine being a 21-year-old male and having your first set of wheels.
Yeah, even if they're subway wheels, it's a huge step in
his freedom.
Freedom for him.
Ticket to ride.
Yeah, and in some ways for you, Geraldine Dawson, you're talking about the need for early intervention here. Glenn Finland and her son David are looking at what it means in adulthood when we have these numbers of autistic fellow citizens. I mean, and she says we need a whole lot more support there. It really brings the cost of what's going on here into focus when you look at that whole range, Dr. Dawson.
You know, absolutely. And I should say, any parent who is worried that their child may have autism, I do suggest that you go to the Autism Speaks website. We have the Learn the Signs. You can look at all of the symptoms that are shown there And also there's a resource guide that you can click on your state and look for resources for diagnosis, but also services for adults. And I think Glenn's point is so well taken, because this is a lifelong condition. And what we want is for every person with autism not only to reach their potential, but to become a productive member of society, to have a job, to be able to contribute, to have a life that is satisfying. And we can do that with the right kinds of supports. We know, for example, that the period of transition from high school into early adulthood is a very critical point. Some parents talk about it as falling off a cliff, because there are very few services, particularly for higher functioning individuals, as they exit high school. And so they can end up living at home, being unemployed, and yet have amazing talents and strong intellectual capability, but just need that extra support to help them become productive members of society.
And that's what we're looking at here. Those kids, you know, marching up in age, these kids. Roy in Somerset, Kentucky is calling. Hi, Roy. Thanks very much. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a parent of a 7-year-old son with autism. When me and his mother found out, it was devastating for us. But what was even more devastating is the lack of support that we're able to get in our community, the lack of educational supports, just getting a physician to take on a child in my community with autism. It's overwhelming, and it puts such a strain on my and my wife's marriage that, you know, sometimes it does cause strains. But
sure,
my son he's such a blessing, but I fear every day of the lack of resources that are going to be available to him in the future.
Roy, do you have a special education program in your local school district that he's part of that gives him extra support, you extra support, or not?
Yes, he is in the special education department of a local school here, but their approach is more of just a one-size-fits-all. The individual needs, I just don't think, are there, and especially from the school that we had him in when he was 4 and 5 was much worse than the one that, but we're actually pleased with the one that we've got him in now compared to what he was in before. The supports there were just awful. Untrained staff, just basically there to babysitting through the day, and it's not preparing him, it's not educating him to get him prepared to even help him grow.
Dr. Wisnitzer in Cleveland, what do you say to a parent like Roy? You can hear his love and concern and yet the struggle at the same time.
I tell them, one, to make sure that they understand what interventions are needed. As Dr. Dawson had stated, Autism Speaks has wonderful resources, including, I call it their first 100 days manual that guides parents through choosing programs. Number two is set a time limit for any intervention plan that's developed through the IEP. Make it either 3 months and 6 months or 6 months. If you don't see an improvement or above and beyond what would be expected, then say, we need to relook at this. Bring in specialists from the outside. Get the resources. I agree with the caller. None of these children should be treated in a way that because we don't know what we're doing, therefore we're going to do the best we can. Ignorance is not an excuse for appropriate education in this regard. And that includes whether it's dealing with medical providers or dealing with the educational community. Mm. Basically advocate and find people who can support them.
But we know and we can hear, Roy, that it's not easy, and we wish all the best luck with that to you and your family. I appreciate your call.
Tom, could I say something
please,
to Roy? I feel your pain, buddy. But I have to say that it gets better. It really does. It takes a lot of maturity to parent a special needs child, and it can be hard on a marriage, but boy, do you need that partner, because you can't do it alone. So let me just give you a tiny, I hate to even use the word advice because we're all so different, but I'll tell you one thing that is important. Broaden your own circle of support. Salt away time for yourself and your partner. You have to refresh the well. You have to get some sleep if you can, and involve other people in your family or your community or church or temple, whatever you can do, if somebody is willing to help, because it is very isolating to have a child with autism. So look outside and see who is there to offer you help, and but, take them up on it.
But that word isolation comes up again and again in these contexts because people don't know how to be helpful exactly, or maybe they're, you know, afraid, or they're afraid of doing or saying the wrong thing. How do you expand that circle, Glenn?
First, look at your family, because a lot of people don't know what to say. And so it's hard to explain to an outsider. In my family, we say, outsiders see and insiders know. But I can only know my son David so well. So when I introduce him to people, I often sort of step back and watch the expression on their faces, and I get a little bit of a giggle from it because they're so lost.
You know, I also think online communities of support can be really helpful. Mm-hmm. I mean, one wants to find healthy and supportive groups online, but and again, just one example is Autism Speaks Facebook community, and there we have over a million people on Facebook now. But it's a place where people are sharing their stories, they're sharing information, they're linking to resources for families that are struggling. So sometimes isolation can be dealt with by connecting with other families online, and it's something we can do now that we couldn't do before, particularly for people mm-hmm. that are isolated in more rural communities.
Dr. Dawson, here's a question online from Melrose. Says, has the link between the MMR vaccine and autism been completely discredited? I noticed that the word vaccine has not even come up so far in this hour. Is that, for some years, that had a lot of attention. Is that off the table now, Dr. Dawson?
Now, there is no evidence that the increase in prevalence that we're seeing in autism spectrum disorder is linked to the MMR vaccine. You know, if vaccines play a role, and there has not been any evidence thus far to show that it has, it would be with a very small minority of individuals who have an underlying medical condition where the vaccine may have triggered an onset of symptoms for an already existing condition or vulnerability. So we do not believe that vaccines are an explanation of the increase, and we strongly encourage parents to get their children vaccinated.
Dr. Wisnitzer, here's another big factor coming up, and pretty soon, I think later this year, right now the very definition of autism and this autism spectrum is being reviewed by the American Psychiatric Association for this Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, of course, the sort of Bible of standard reference for mental disorders and defining them. Now, there's a lot of expectation I'm reading here, Doctor, that they're going to narrow the definition. So is it possible that we're just going to, you know, define this problem away at a nomenclature level somehow and say, oh, no, we got too broad and we're narrowing the definition, so they're not our problem anymore. They don't have autism.
Well, this has been studied. And this has also been studied in terms of chart reviews and trying to take DSM-4 and DSM-5 criteria and seeing if they fit. And what the DSM-5 is planning to do is break down the three major groupings of autism as defined presently, which is problems with socialization, problems with communication, restricted interests and repetitive behaviors, and breaking it down to their core essence, which is a problem of socialization and social communication. The communication problem mainly deals with social behaviors, as well as the restricted interests and repetitive behaviors. When this has been looked at, there has been some small dropout. They said about 10% of the study population in one of the papers. And the other one, basically, there seemed to be no difference, which was a study from England. However, this is just done on a chart review based on answers that parents were giving to questions. I think we have to wait and see. One of the things the CDC is going to do is actually compare the two in their upcoming studies of the prevalence to see if there really is a major difference in that. Can I just say one quick thing about what you were talking about before about the isolation? Mm-hmm. Everything we've been listening to is jobs and things like this. Jobs are 8 to 5. What do we do with individuals with autism and other developmental disorders between 5 p.m. and 8 a.m. and also all weekend? One way to reverse the isolation is get them out in the community, do leisure time activities, make them dynamic, integrated individuals in the community. if they're isolated from the community, the community does not know them, does not understand them. If the community sees them, they realize them for the individuals and that they are, not the autisms that they are, but the individuals that they are, which is a key important point. These are delightful individuals. They have their own personalities. They have their own temperaments, which is why I've been working with them all these years. Mm. I enjoy the kids, and I think it's important to recognize that there's more than just getting a job.
Glenn, let us give you the last word on that. Our time's short here. We're not going to solve all this, but for everybody who's listening who may not be part of this world of autism in their families or immediate circle, what's your advice on how to make this world we share more comfortable for children or young adults like your David?
Tell our stories. I really feel that's important. And Max, I like what you just said. I totally agree with you. Because we families who live it every day may not understand it, but we get it.
You get it. You live with it. You're David out in the world right now at 24, and we wish him well. There will be many more in his footsteps if these numbers are anything like right, and we're hearing today. They surely are somewhere in that zone. Glenn Findlay's new memoir is called Next Stop, and it's terrific. Glenn, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Geraldine Dawson, Chief Science Officer with Autism Speaks. Thank you, Dr. Dawson.
Well, thank you for having this program.
And Dr. Max Wisnitzer at Rainbow and Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland. Thanks, Max.
Thank you very much.
This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.